From the Rhodes Centre for International Economics and Finance at Brown University, this is the Rhodes Centre podcast. I'm the director of the centre and your host, Mark Blyth. For as long as this thing we call capitalism has existed, it has had its fair share of critics. And indeed, you probably heard more than a few on this very podcast. As our guest on this episode explains, when it comes to understanding this globe-spanning economic system, where it came from, how it shaped our world, and where it's going, those critics might be some of our best guides. John Cassidy is a staff writer at The New Yorker, covering politics and economics. In his new book, Capitalism and Its Critics, A History from the Industrial Revolution to AI, tells the story of capitalism in a way you haven't heard before. It's an epic history filled with fascinating characters and big ideas. So I had him on the podcast to talk about it. We started with an insider whistleblowing critic of the Dutch East India Company in the 18th century and ended by discussing someone who questions capitalism's compatibility with democracy in the 20th century. So, buckle up, let's go. John, welcome back, I guess. We didn't do a podcast last time you were here, but welcome back to Watson.
Thanks very much for inviting me on.
So with a book like this, it's hard to know where to jump in. Luckily, John just gave us a talk here at Watson where he said, let's organize it. And he gave us some themes: globalization, technological disruption, inequality, capitalism and democracy. This book basically, John does a kind of biographical historiography and substantive accounting of the ideas of pretty much anyone who's worth listening to about capitalism, basically since its inception. That's why it's a big book. So it does make sense to organize it in themes. The first one you brought up was globalization. It's always been there. Capital's always been global. You start off with a brilliant telling of a whistleblower. Tell us about the whistleblower. Why did you decide to start there?
Yeah, William Bolts, who was a Dutchman who moved to England and went to work for the East India Company, which was a royally sanctioned monopoly, which had a monopoly on all the trade east of the Cape of Good Hope. It was a huge company, big multinational corporation with headquarters in Eastcheap in London. The reason I started with them was because the book is basically about industrial capitalism, but I wanted to show that industrial capitalism was built on the form of a pre-existing capitalism, mercantile capitalism, and the East India Company was an exemplar of mercantile capitalism. And the fact it had a whistleblower, William Bolts, who had basically fallen out with the company because they fired him because he was privateering too much, making too much profit himself, and they sent him back to London. So he said, you know, you've screwed me, I'm going to screw you. And he wrote a tell-all about how the company had exploited the native population in India for centuries. So as I said, I thought that was a good way to start the book because, number one, one of the big themes in this book is that a lot of the sort of fundamental traits of capitalism and also the fundamental sort of contradictions and faults which have given risen to criticisms all through the years go back to the very beginning. And you see that in the East India Company itself. It was basically an exemplar of sort of imperialism. It would also a sort of self-dealing. And actually, at the start of my book, it's getting bailed out by the government because it had overextended. It had a private armies in India which were very costly. And it spent so much on wars that it ran out of money and had to go back to Parliament and say, look, we're bankrupt. We need bailing out. And some people said, well, why should we bail you out? And the reason they bailed them out was the one same one used in 2008, largely, that they were too big to fail. So that's how I start the book, showing that sort of globalization has been intrinsic to capitalism from the beginning. And then I have one chapter on the end about sort of high globalization in the 1990s and 2000s. But the theme runs through the book from the sort of Communist Manifesto of 1848, Marx and Engels have famous ringing passages about globalization, to the sort of critiques of high imperialism in the late 19th century, from people like John Hobson, the English liberal, and Rosa Luxemburg, the German communist, and through the 20th century when globalization sort of retreated in the 20s and 30s and then was sort of reconstructed in a limited way in the Keynesian post-war system, the Bretton Woods system, and then in a massive way when capitalism truly went global in, you know, post-Cold War when China and India joined the global economy. So that's one of the themes which runs runs through the book from start to finish.
So let's, a couple of the names that you picked up there I want to highlight because we don't highlight them enough. Hobson. So Hobson's basically not talking about mercantile capitalism. He's talking about imperialism, but he sees them as almost kind of like the same thing, but different.
Linked, yeah, linked. Hobson was a fascinating character because, he saw himself as liberal. He mixed in liberal circles in England. He actually, the reason he went to South Africa, which gave the material for his book on imperialism, was because The Guardian, the great liberal news, British little newspaper, hired him as a special correspondent. That was just before the Boer War. And he went over there. And his basic version of imperialism was very much framed on the sort of British South African model, Cecil Rhodes. But he sort of tried to link it to a more theoretical basis, that capitalism, because it's so unequal, produces these great surpluses which sort of pile up in the hands of the capitalists, people like Rhodes, and need an outlet. So he sees the sort of scramble for Africa as a sort of outlet for surplus capital, which they then invested in gold mines. That was the basis of the Boer War. The British wanted access to the gold mines, which were in a Dutch-run region, and it eventually led to war. So Hobson, makes the argument that wasn't just a South African phenomenon. Capitalism always produces massive surpluses. So it was a sort of a theoretical basis of imperialism that it wasn't just all based on racism or sort of jingoism. There was an economic rationale for it. And that proved incredibly influential in left-wing circles. Mm. Rosa Luxemburg and others picked up on this and produced similar versions, not identical, but the sort of economic version of imperialism. A, that you need surplus capital always plays a prominent role, but also the need to develop overseas markets and to get raw materials for the system. They're the sort of two versions, one the surplus capital and two the sort of demand and supply needs that it fulfills.
So let me jump forward from there and link to something else. Those set of arguments are around. They sort of fall into abeyance for a little bit in that kind of golden age period. But one place where they are alive in that period and come back strong was the dependency arguments in Latin America. And you made a point of actually singling that out, which I thought was interesting. What was your thoughts on that?
Well, one thing is I wanted to make the book a global book because capitalism is a global phenomenon and there have been critiques all over the world. Part of it was just a sort of journalistic thing. I wanted to include South America in some way, but also the dependency theories of the post-war era were actually very influential in their time. And they sort of linked in to, as you say, the earlier critiques of capitalism, especially on the left. The dependency theory basically came in two forms too. There was a sort of left Keynesian version of it, who I associate with Raul Prebisch, the Argentinian economist. And then there was a full-on Marxist version of it, which I associate with Anders Gunder Frank and his followers. But they both shared the idea. They both shared the basic model of capitalism, of global capitalism, of sort of center and periphery, core and periphery. And that the core is basically exploiting the periphery in various ways and preventing it from developing fully. One of the famous books in the dependency movement was called The Development of Underdevelopment, i.e. the system, global system wasn't there to develop developing economies, it was there to exploit them in various ways. And even when it did allow some development, that was always very limited and couldn't form the basis for truly independent and nationalist development. So it was a very pessimistic view of the world and of the sort of possibilities of developing countries doing anything really well under capitalism. And it was extremely influential in the 60s and 70s, not just in Latin America, but it also spread to Africa too. I mentioned Samir Amin, the very prominent African Marxist. And it only really got challenged on the left or with the sort of rise of China and India when they integrated themselves successfully into the capitalist model. It was obviously a brutal process involving a lot of sweatshops, etc. But it did show that there is more possibility for countries to develop within global capitalism and then sort of move up the value chain than the dependency theories had allowed for. Now, there are still people who are still believe strongly in dependence theory and would argue with me there. But again, it's another example of how these theories sort of bubble up and then disappear and come back in various similar forms.
Let's pick another area that you highlighted or we could run through the book, which is inequality. And I want to start with an unusual one because, again, this is not someone you hear a lot about. Everyone knows one phrase, and that's about it, Carlyle.
Yeah. Well, I again, that was Thomas Carlyle, early 19th century to mid 19th century British writer, Scottish writer, which is maybe why Mark brought him up. And a great literary figure, of course. But he also was a great critic of early capitalism, but from the right.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I wanted about the book, I didn't just want it to be a litany of left-wing critiques. Obviously, most of the critiques of capitalist abuse have come from the left. But there have also been a strain going back to Carlyle and even before the Romantic poets of critiques from the left, of the right of capitalism. So what are those critiques? One of them is moralist, is a moral argument that capitalism is based on selfishness and greed, so it can never be a moral system. In a lot of the right-wing critics were religious, and they saw it as contrary to sort of the rules of going back to, I guess, Jesus throwing the rich people out of the temple. They argued that it was a damned system. That was very much Carlyle's basis. He thought it was an immoral system, but he also focused on its how it gave rise to inequality, and has passages which read as if they could have been written by Marx or Engels or some of the British and French pre-Marxist socialists, and basically just pointing out the basic dividing line between people who own capital and people who don't. Because, these days with 401ks and everything in developed countries, rich countries, the basic class dividing line has been blurred somewhat in that the workers have at least a bit of a stake in the system. Obviously, in the US, where there's massive inequality, they don't have much of a stake. But in the 19th century, the dividing line was very rigid. You were either a worker who had only his labor to sell, member of the proletariat, or else you were a capitalist. And Carlyle just saw this as immoral. And his solution, of course, was proto-fascist, basically. Mm. He was a great defender of the great man theory. Frederick William the Great was his great hero. He had no time for democracy, and he basically wanted a great man dictator to come along and sort of impose morality from above.
So someone else who pops up later on also has a kind of moral critique, even though it is much more of an economist moral critique, and this is Veblen. The whole notion of conspicuous consumption, which is only possible when you have great inequality.
Yeah.
And then he levers this into a very unique way of thinking about these problems.
Yeah, I mean, Thorstein Veblen, is a great figure. But these days gets studied more in terms of sociology departments, I think, than economics. But he was an economist, always viewed himself as an economist, and had had economic appointments at various leading universities. He was a very controversial figure. He eventually got fired from several of them for not for anything he'd written, but because he had a predilection for having affairs with his colleagues' wives, which tended to get him drummed out. He got drummed out of Stanford for that, and he ended up in the University of Missouri. But his background, he came from a sort of rural background. His parents were sort of Norwegian farmers in Minnesota. So he came from a sort of plains radicalism, great plains radicalism, populist background. And that sort of suspicion of great centers of economic power and of industrialization of what he called the captains of industry ran through all his work. So in my account of Veblen, I basically focus on two things. One, I do mention his critique of capitalism as sort of, and GDP as sort of worthless in some sense, because a lot of consumption is just, trying to keep up with the neighbors. Conspicuous consumption, as he wrote about it. In those days, this was the era when the great oligarchs of the late 19th century were busy building the sort of Rockefellers.
Yeah,
and
the mansions at Newport down the road.
Exactly, the mansions at Newport down the road here, the mansions on the Upper West Side in Manhattan. So he focused on that. And he's a very funny writer. That was in his book, The Theory of the Leisure Class. But he also followed that up with a book, A Theory of Business Enterprise, in which he had a sort of very modern critique of corporations, which he saw. He wasn't anti-capitalist. the old school capitalist, the man who owned his factory and walked around the floor and sort of interacted with the workers and made sure that everything was working. To Veblen, that was a member of the productive class. He made a big demarcation between productive people, workers, and capitalists, so actual people who owned the means of production and were there, and the unproductive class, who were basically all the leeches. And he saw most of sort of modern business, the sort of accountants and the advertisers and the administrative staff, they were the unproductive class. And he, as capitalism developed, he thought that class would get bigger and bigger. So his solution was, not clear whether he was full-on revolutionary, but he believed in a sort of government of technocrats and engineers. And later in life, he wrote a book about the sort of the socialism of engineering. And he originally had high hopes for the Soviets in that sense, that they would sort of run the economy on a rational basis and allow the engineers to take over. So, you know, he's a fascinating figure, Veblen, and there's much more to him than just conspicuous consumption.
Let's round this out with the person you end up with to tie this thread up, which is Piketty. How does he fit into this sort of like chain of thinking about inequality for you?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's this very strange sort of hiatus in thinking about inequality inside economics. I mean, I think average people still thought of inequality. They still thought of rich people and poor people, and we're still sort of, you know, some people are outraged by it. But in economics, in the post-war era, during the great sort of Keynesian era, inequality sort of disappeared as a subject of study. When I was in college in the 1980s and I went to, you know, a couple of very elite institutions, you basically didn't study inequality at all. Now, there are a couple of reasons for that, I think. Number one, there was a theoretical reason, in that the economists had persuaded themselves that you couldn't make interpersonal comparisons theoretically. I don't know how many listeners are economists, but this whole theory that, you know, it was impossible to make interpersonal comparisons of utility. So all you could concentrate on were trades which benefited everybody. If you did well for economics, you looked for Pareto improvements. Mm-hmm. And a Pareto improvement is when, you know, you help somebody without damaging anybody else. And, you know, it's a useful concept. But Bill Gates, a future Bill Gates, owning 90% of the world's wealth and everybody else owning 10 or even 1% of it, that's perfectly compatible with a Pareto optimality. Mm-hmm. So, you know, economists didn't have anything really much to say about inequality for theoretical reasons.
It was like, don't look here, look over there.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. But also, at the same time, you know, the statistics show, and Piketty and his colleagues did show this, that inside Western countries, inequality had declined substantially over the course of the 20th century up till about 1980 because of the Keynesian social democracy, which had strong trade unions, strong social insurance nets, and higher taxes on the rich. You know, the taxes in England when I was a kid, top tax rate was 95%. You know, the song Taxman by the Beatles.
Right.
So, 5 pence would be 95 pence for the taxman. That was an anti-tax song. So inequality, as a result of that, inequality, and there was also the financial sector was a great source of inequality, was also sort of squashed, what they called financial repression. So inequality wasn't as big a problem as it became after the sort of, you know, Reagan-Thatcher revolution, when there was deregulation, lower taxes, assault on the labor unions, and globalization. And that all produced a massive increase in inequality. So Piketty's role, and it wasn't just him, there are others who I mention in the book, including an American, Ed Wolfe, who I studied with at NYU.
Right. Tony Atkinson,
in the UK. But that movement, that group, the great thing they did, and Piketty's sort of genius in a way, was put the development of inequality in terms that people could understand, especially in pictures. Those pictures showing the U shape of the sort of shares of the top 1%, the top 5%, the top 0.01% of wealth and income, they entered the political debate, not just the economic debate. And, you know, you had the Occupy Wall Street movement, you know, these terms like 1%, 0.1%, they became part of the popular debates, and they still are. That's very unusual for an economic theory or for an economic theoretician. And then Piketty himself, when he put it all together in a popular book, which, you know, everybody bought but nobody read, was the same. Probably, I wish mine was the same. You can all buy it or you don't have to read it. That he was a celebrity, you know, for a while.
Absolutely.
I mean, I start my chapter on him with an event in London, which was sold out at a theater. And, you know, people were lining up around the block as if it was sort of a rock concert or whatever. it was a good way to tell the story of how inequality became a huge issue. Now, there's Piketty, there's also a sort of international aspect of it, which isn't captured in the work of Piketty, but there was also some very important empirical work done there by Branko Milanović and his colleagues at the World Bank. They did for global inequality what Piketty and his colleagues did for domestic inequality, I think. They brought it to the masses. And also another very clever chart, the elephant chart, which Branko and his colleague first published in, I think, about 2010 and then produced various versions thereof, which shows in graphical terms how in the last, since the sort of high globalization era, the gains in income have been concentrated in the sort of middle classes of the developing world, basically China and India. At the same time, the further up the elephant, the middle classes of the developed world have stagnated. We sort of knew that, but to see it on one chart, I think, was extremely influential. Piketty was a way to sort of tell the story of how inequality made a comeback in economics.
It came back in, yeah. So let's round it out with a discussion of capitalism and democracy. What I've tried to do is avoid Keynes and avoid Marx and avoid Hayek and Friedman, because they're the ones that everyone always takes as their touch point.
Right.
So we're going to assume that people know the broad contours of that. A couple of things I want to say. The treatment of Hayek and Friedman in the book and the sort of the neoliberalism in general is it was a critique of capitalism. It wasn't capitalism, rah, rah, rah. It was a critique very much of Keynesian capitalism. But there were other people who were on the left who were critical of Keynesian capitalism. They don't get enough airtime. One of my personal favorites, of course, is Mikhail Kolesky. So let's start with Kolesky.
Yeah, well, I one of the things I wanted to do in the book was exactly point out that Keynesianism, although it was hegemonic for 30 years, had critics on the left and the right. The right-wing Hayek and Friedman, you know, are world-famous names. But back in the 1940s, when the system was being put together, there were also some critics on the left who were Keynesians in the sense that they believed in Keynesian macroeconomic policies using the government and deficits to offset recessions, etc. But they made broader arguments, Mikhail Kolesky and Paul Sweezy, an American Marxist, both very similar but independently working in the 1940s. And their argument was that Keynesianism looks great and sort of works from a technocratic basis in that, you know, if we do have a system in which runs at full employment, basically, and has sort of strong labor unions and strong social welfare system, you know, that could be a good system, could raise wages, could narrow inequality, and could sort of take the rough edges off capitalism. They didn't deny that. Their critique was that it won't be sustainable in the long term on political economy grounds, because basically it will eventually lead to a revolt of the capitalists and the corporate class. And writing in the, both because there'll be a profit squeeze, but also because Kolesky made much of the sort of fact that they lose their prerogatives in the workplace, etc. So it wasn't just purely economic argument, it was sort of power argument that their status and their power in the workplace would be undermined and that eventually they wouldn't put up with it. For 20 or 30 years, that critique seemed, if not redundant, at least sort of in abeyance, because Keynesian, you know, the les trente glorieuses, as the French call it, the great 30 years, when we did have strong, I'm talking in terms of Western transatlantic economies, developed economies, had strong non-inflationary equitable growth, basically shared rising prosperity. And that's the world I sort of grew up in, and I'm sure you did too, Mark. But in the 70s, what did we see? We actually did see a sort of revolt from the capitalist class, if you want to call it that in crude terms, the business classes, and a profit squeeze. I mentioned the work of Andrew Glynn and others on Britain in the late 60s, where he saw a profit squeeze. There was also one in the US. So in a sense, the sort of right-wing counter-revolution of the 80s and 90s vindicated the left-wing critics of capitalism from the 1940s. And I wanted to tell that story because I don't think it's well known.
Yeah, I actually assigned Kolesky's 1944 Political Quarterly piece.
Right.
If anyone has the time to find this thing, it's incredible. He basically predicts exactly what you said, the politics of the late 70s. In 1944, in seven easy-to-understand pages.
Yeah, no,
it's quite a remarkable piece.
No, it is a remarkable piece. Yeah, no, I do quote from it pretty extensively in the book. I mean, as I said, one of the goals of when you're writing a book like this, which is basically a history of the world or a history of economic thought from a critical perspective anyway, I think one of the keys, you have to write about certain people because they, you know, they are just such an important part of the story, people like Keynes and Friedman and Hayek, etc. But in writing the book, the most interesting stuff is the stuff you didn't know.
Yeah.
And coming across people like, I mean, Kalecki's always been a cult figure on the left, partly because of his theoretical work, his early theoretical work, which is very mathematical, but he's a sort of proto-Keynesianism. Mm-hmm. A lot of people say, oh, look, he wrote the general theory before the general theory because his paper came out in like 1933 or whatever. So that's interesting. I'm interested in theory. But the political economy side of it, I didn't realize it was so strong. And I think that's what he should really be remembered for because, as you say, it was a sort of, you know, it was so far ahead of its time.
Definitely. Let's bring it back to someone that we both like who doesn't get enough airtime, but these days is getting more and more, Karl Polanyi.
Yeah, well, Karl Polanyi, again, another figure I didn't know much about. I mean, when I was studying economics, he's not a sort of economic theorist, so it was totally ignored in the curriculum. The fascinating thing about Polanyi, I think, is that his work sort of reflects his experience and his sort of intellectual apparatus in a way which sort of comes together. Now, that's true of everybody. We're all products of our environment and our upbringing. But Polanyi had such a dramatic and fascinating upbringing that I wanted to explain that. He basically came out of Hungary and Austria as an educated member of the sort of the Jewish family. Father was an industrialist. And, you know, grew up in the sort of Findlay-Sakel society. His mother was a member of, you know, all sorts of artistic groups and sort of the height of, a bit of an archaic phrase, but sort of European civilization or whatever you want to call it in the sort of, you know, pre-First World War era. And then he saw it all collapse.
Right.
You know, he saw the authoritarians take over in Hungary. He moved to Vienna, where he spent 10 years in Red Vienna, which people don't know enough about either, was a great experiment in municipal socialism in the 1920s in Vienna, very successful for a decade, but then was brought down again by the rise of Austro-fascism and Dollfuss. And this obviously colored Polanyi's view of the world. And in the 1930s, when he moved to London, he'd been a journalist, he turned into an academic and started writing about it in the sort of what I would call political economy. And his first major subject was this question of capitalism, fascism, and democracy, and how they were interrelated. Now, from the liberal perspective in which I grew up in, liberal Keynesian perspective, it's always automatically assumed. I don't think I ever heard very, very few people in that tradition question it, all obviously on the extreme left people have always questioned it, this sort of equation between capitalism and democracy, that they were mutually supportive, maybe even mutually necessary. Keynes certainly believed that, and most of his followers did. But Polanyi had a much darker view. His argument was that capitalism, untrammeled capitalism, both of the 19th century model and what he saw as the interwar period, his interpretation of the interwar period was that the great mistake was trying to recreate sort of unfettered capitalism on a 19th century model. And his argument was that unfettered capitalism is basically completely unstable in the long term on political economy grounds because it produces such social stresses, such technological and political upheavals that democracy can't survive. Mm. You get radicalism on the right and the left. So he wrote these pieces in the 1930s saying sort of, you know, not just sort of, explicitly saying that the only conceivable outcomes in the long term were either one of the extremes, socialism on the left, which he called democratizing the economy, or fascism, which he called removing the economic sphere completely from democracy. And again, this is the 1930s he was writing about. In the post-war era, when Keynesianism was in the ascendancy for so long, these ideas were just completely forgotten. Mm-hmm. And I would say were even really forgotten until the 21st century. But after the sort of collapse of globalization and high globalization and deregulation in the global financial crisis and the rise of both a substantial left-wing movement like Occupy Wall Street, the Bernie Sanders campaign, but also more scarily, you know, the sort of right-wing resurgence that we hadn't seen like since the 1920s and 30s, I think that thrusts Polanyi and his sort of pessimistic view of things back into the mainstream, and you have to consider it. Now, of course, you also have to consider his later work, which you've written about at length, The Great Transformation, in which it's a bit more optimistic. I mean, after he moved to America, he became a, when he moved to Bennington College eventually, and then taught at Columbia for a decade, he became a bit more upbeat. He was a big fan of Roosevelt. He was also a fan of the post-war Labour government for a time. And I think he came to sort of be more optimistic of the prospects of social democracy. Although towards the end of his life, he became more pessimistic again. But he had this theory, which you've written about, framework, this, you know, the double movement, which you've written about at length. I think that really is just such a helpful framework for thinking about things now, because it sort of ties the political and the economic together. And just for those of you who don't know what the double movement is, Polanyi said you get the first movement is the sort of deregulation of capitalism, but that is so sort of destructive and stressful to society that it produces counter movements, the double movement, second movement, whatever, in terms of rising sort of populist movements, trade unions, efforts to regulate finance, etc. And the way I see things now is that we're in the sort of second half of the double movement. We had the great deregulation again of the 90s and early 2000s, 80s, 90s, early 2000s, which in many ways echoed what happened in the interwar period, where it was sort of, you know, trying to recreate an idealized free market capitalism. Eventually it blew up in the great financial crisis, produced massive inequality, wage stagnation, etc. And, you know, that has produced these incredible, alarming political ramifications in the rise of right-wing, you know, authoritarian movements across the developed world.
Yeah, he calls them re-embedding movements, trying exactly. to basically re-embed that disembodied right. economy back in society.
Exactly. I mean, his view was that capitalism, successful capitalism, in a way, is always embedded in social institutions, and that, you know, attempts to disembed them, as you, yeah. as we did in the sort of 90s or whatever, lead to catastrophe. So, I mean, you don't have to accept all that. You know, it's a very deterministic model. Mm-hmm. The sort of historian in me would say it's overly deterministic. but, you know, the point of models is to sort of, you know, explain a lot by a little.
Yeah.
And just as the sort of original Keynesian model explained a lot about the economy with a relative little, I think the Polanyi framework gives you a way to think about these things, even if you don't think, you know, everything's predetermined.
That's a good point to leave it. Let's hope not everything is predetermined. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Mark. I enjoyed our conversation.
If you like this episode, leave us a rating and a review on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And be sure to subscribe to the show while you're at it. We'll be back soon with another episode of the Road Centre podcast. Thanks for listening.